Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
All right, so we were talking about t-tests last time, just to finish up on that. There are some assumptions of t-tests. I'll tell you about which ones you can kind of violate and which ones you can't. Assumptions are like that. The assumptions are there because the math behind this, if you might remember this from back when you were taking math in high school, where when you were proving a theorem or something like that, or proving an identity, or even doing you know, geometry, things like that, you know, the angle side angle theorem and all that kind of stuff, you'd always at the beginning assume certain things, and there's always math behind these things, and the assumptions are there because of the math. We can find out how much we can violate them by people doing like Monte Carlo experiments. So the first one is a simple random sample, SRS. So it has to be a simple random sample. That's because of the central limit theorem. You know what? You can violate this. You can violate this pretty nastily, actually, and not worry a great deal about it. So, because you might think, oh, well, none of my thesis experiments, you guys are in thesis, or none of the experiments any going to do are about using simple random samples. It doesn't really matter. Independence of observations, that's a really important one. You cannot violate that. Independence of observations means that if I know Stephanie's score, I don't know anything about Danielle's score. Okay? It has to work that way. So it's one set of scores can't depend on another. And you say, wait, Dave, what about the dependent sample t-test? Well, we take one score, subtract another, and get a single score. So we can't have scores that depend on each other. They have to be independent. And that really is important. That's one you cannot violate. There are ways to analyze data with dependent dependent observations, but they aren't t-tests. So that's something you can take care of in design, right? That's a research design question, really. Homogeneity of variance. Technically, the variances, if let's say you're using two groups, using the old independent sample t-test, the variances should actually be equal. And they never are. The question is, how unequal can they be? And the rule of thumb is, if one's four times bigger than another, you should probably not use the independent sample t-test. You might have trouble with it. At the very least, use the pooled variance estimate, but you might not even be able to use the independent sample t-test in that case. Okay?
Variances?
No, the variances. See, because you think about it, if we say they come from the same distribution, right? That's the null hypothesis. That means the mu's are the same. That also really means the variances are the same because it's the same distribution. We can violate this quite severely, but not ridiculously. So the nice thing is, you know what happens? The test gets more conservative. It doesn't make false positives. It starts making more and more false negatives. So at least you don't make an idiot of yourself. But you might miss something that's actually there. Now, there are ways to deal with the violations to this, and we'll talk about that in a few weeks, where you can actually kind of fix your data. And I don't mean like just changing numbers systematically for a good reason. So there are ways to fix this. And that's it for the t-tests. All right. So next, any questions about t-tests in general or about that last little bit about assumptions? No. From the beginning. What's that over there? Okay. You good with that? Okay, this is a very hard one to understand, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it. And it's hard because you have to think backwards. I'm mostly concerned that you understand this conceptually. Okay? We'll talk about power. We care a lot about type 1 error, and that's probably a good thing. We don't like false positives. We set our own alpha. I mean, our statistical tests are set up this way, right? We set alpha. So we must care a great deal about type 1 error, or we wouldn't be actually picking a number and saying 0.05 all the time. Our software, in fact, and by the way, again, tomorrow, 11:30, computer lab, Amy will be giving a little tutorial on using whatever they've changed the name of SPSS to. So be there. Software, in fact, and you'll see this when you do a little t-test on a couple of sets of values, it actually gives you an exact p-value. It tells you, you know, less than 0.0372 or something. So the math is actually, it works this way. The whole thing is set up around type 1 error. Why is type 1 error more important than type 2 error? I got that in quotes there because I don't know if it is more important, but we seem to think a lot about it. And in fact, we worry a lot about alpha levels. People get all upset when you, I told you about the story about an editor telling me I couldn't discuss a non-significant effect at 0.0504. You know, ooh, maybe it's a false positive that goes along with everything else that happened. Come on. But that's a pretty standard response from a lot of people. So why do we care more about type 2 errors? We're false negative, you know. We don't like those either. We're missing something. Well, historically, Fisher thought, actually, the null hypothesis. The null hypothesis is an interesting thing. It's a straw man. You know a straw man argument? When you're arguing with somebody, you set up a straw man, right, which is just like something you're going to beat down. That's the idea. Well, the null hypothesis is a straw man. We don't actually do experiments trying to prove the null hypothesis because it's logically impossible. It, you know, Fisher thought it was real for some reason, and Fisher invented the F-test, so you got to kind of trust Fisher, I guess. So historically, he actually thought there was the possibility of, you know, you would do these things and sometimes you'd be looking for no effect. Okay. And all the methods are set up that way. I mean, we care about this because, in fact, the math all works that way. So that's a bit circular, I guess. Why do we set things up that way? Because they're set up that way. Okay, in fact, I believe that's completely circular. Nonetheless, it's probably easier to do stuff that way. And you'll see in a second why it actually is easier. Right? It's easier to set up a situation, a straw man argument, saying that nothing happened. Everything comes in the same distribution. That's an easy thing to do. Because on the other way of doing it, you'd have to say something happened and it was this. And that's hard. And that, in fact, is what the rest of today's class is going to be about. Something hard. Thinking about what happened and what was it before I do the damned experiment. You got to have some kind of powers of clairvoyance or something. You got to be able to bend spoons like Uri Geller. Nobody? Uri Geller? No, didn't think so. Good. He was an Israeli psychic in the 1970s. It was shown to be a complete fraud, obviously, which was awesome. So for HA, we actually have to know how big the effect is. Think about that. For HO, we have to say nothing. That's easy. That's an easy one to set up. Nothing happened. If I say, what's HA? And you go, let's see, that there are 5 points different, and that the variance on this one is this, and the variance on this one's that. That's not an easy thing to do. It's not easy. It's a lot easier to say nothing. Just nothing happened. So I think that's probably why. Now, in the best of all possible worlds, we would minimize alpha and beta, because those are both errors. We don't want to make errors. And, of course, by minimizing beta, we would have the most power we could, because power is the probability of rejecting a false null hypothesis. That's what we want to do. You can't prove the null, first of all. It's logically impossible. Secondly, why are you doing experiments? You know, why are you collecting data unless you think something probably happened? You're not sitting there hoping, oh, I hope nothing turns out here. And sometimes you do a bunch of experiments. You do one, there's one little thing in the middle, and you say, yeah, I'm kind of hoping nothing happens here because it fits with my theory. But, you know, typically that's in the grand scheme of things. You're looking for effects. So we want to maximize power and minimize both kinds of errors. And again, power is the probability of rejecting HO given HA is true. That's what that notation means. It's conditional probability. You might remember that from such classes as grade 12 math. Or in my case, grade 13 algebra. Oh. Wow, grade 13 algebra. Where I failed the test on probability. I got 42. And I really, that's pretty abysmal, right? He used to post our marks. He'd put a circle around the marks where they failed, so you knew right away you were in the circle club. Oh, yeah. 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 He looked like Gargamel from the Smurfs, my grade 13. And he talked like this. It was pretty intense. We actually bought him a Gargamel doll for Christmas. It was great. And he got the joke, of course, right away, because how couldn't he? It's like looking in a mirror. Ah, memories. Anyway, probability of rejecting HO given HA is true. Okay, now, as it says here, pictures with 1,000 words. The nice thing about doing this with Keynote is that I don't have to draw this picture anymore. I used to draw this on the board, and it was an evil, bad, nasty thing to do. I can't draw. I'm blind, man. Give me a break. But also, I just can't draw. So you put all that together, and it used to be a horrible thing. Let's take a look at this diagram first, and then we'll talk a bit about it. What we have here is, here's the null hypothesis distribution on the left, HO. Okay. Here's the alternative hypothesis distribution on the right, HA. Now, let's look in the null hypothesis distribution for a second. That's alpha. It's probably 0.05, whatever. We don't have to worry about it. It's alpha. If we get a score that's here or greater, we reject the null hypothesis, don't we? So anywhere from here on, we reject the null. Now, let's take a look at if HO is true. You're making a mistake, actually, because HO is true. Now, let's say H1, as it says here, or HA is true. That's here, okay? Now, that means that anything from there on, remember, it's the probability of rejecting HO given HA is true, so that means this is true. That's your power. That's a nice big number. Here's the probability of you making a false negative. Rejecting HA, given HA is true. Because it's going to be a value less than alpha, but it's going to be in this distribution here. So it's from there to the left. It's actually a pretty big number. It's actually a pretty big number. So it's really all about overlap, isn't it? If the HO and the HA distributions don't overlap at all, we're not going to make any... It's very unlikely we would make any errors. Any type 2 errors. We'll make type 1 errors. That'll happen. But it's unlikely we can't make any type 2s because, that's all about overlap, isn't it? Right? So how could you increase the power of a test? And we just had that on the quiz, but anyway, we could make alpha bigger. Because how are we going to make this quantity here, power, how are we going to make this thing bigger? Well, why don't we just move this over here? Make it here. Make our new alpha 0.2. Wow, suddenly this thing, this power thing, this shifts all over here. Oh, it's beautiful. Could do that? You could. No one would publish your article, but you could. So practically you can't do that, but theoretically you could. There are cases where, in fact, you would do that. You don't care so much about false negatives. I mentioned things like public health things. Right? I don't care if they tell me to boil the water and it's a bit of an inconvenience. I'd rather do that even if the water was fine because there's an off chance that maybe I get, you know, Giardia. Actually, secondhand smoke from cigarettes, you know, none of it ever shows up at 0.05. It just doesn't. So by standard scientific techniques, you can't say that secondhand smoke is bad for anybody. That being said, what they did is they basically keep saying, well, you know, this is a public health issue. And I got some sympathy there. Right? So if you make it 0.1, things like that, then you can say, yeah, that's fine. Then you can have the argument about all kinds of other things. But the point is there, again, it's a public health issue. I kind of get changing the alpha level. But usually you can't. Oh, we could increase the difference between mu1 and mu0. Why don't we do that? So all we would have to do, instead of moving alpha over, why don't we just take this distribution H1 or HA and put it over here? Now they don't overlap anymore. You could do that. Theoretically. Practically, can you? Well, no. You can't move parameters. It gives you the ego to think you can move a parameter. People line up to worship you on Sundays? No, there's nothing you can do there. It's too bad. It would be nice. We could just say, huzzah, and then it would move. But, you know, maybe someday when the singularity happens, maybe we can do that. But right now, we can't do that. Yep.
I don't care about mu1 minus mu0.
Mu1 minus mu0, that would be the difference between here and here. Take this and put it over here. Take the same distribution and move it over here to the right. Or move the mu zero to the left.
How do you do that?
You can't. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You could, how could you get rid of that overlap? Well, you could just move them over, but you really practically can't. You could play with alpha, and you almost always practically can't, unless it's really a huge public health thing, is usually the when people do that. Boil orders for water. Secondhand cigarette smoking, frankly. Environmental emissions. A lot of times people say, look, 0.05, we understand, but making a scientific point is one thing. Making a public health point is probably something else. And I'm, depending on the issue, pretty sympathetic to that idea. Pretty sympathetic to it. We could, yeah. I mean, theoretically, we can't. But that would be a way to do it. What we really can do is we can decrease sigma. Now, you're saying, wait a second, Dave, that's a parameter, too. We can't, yeah, but when we make our statistical decision, we aren't actually using population distributions. We're using sampling distributions of the mean. Right? We don't use population distributions. We use sampling distributions of the mean, and we want to see if they overlap. Central limit theory tells us, oh, well, then we can change. If the sampling distributions overlap, it probably means also there's some overlap between the population distributions. Remember, the means are the same, etc. You see, remember again, Danielle was having trouble understanding this, and it's understandable because you really can't do that. You could, if, like I said, just looking at the picture, don't worry about what the things mean. If you can move stuff, you can do that.
So you're just saying that to do this, you just need to minimize your error?
Yeah. Less variance, yes. Stephanie.
Okay. So to decrease your variance, you can, or standard deviation, you can increase your sample size.
That's right. That's exactly what you do. Because central limit theorem tells us that it's going to be sigma divided by square root of n.
Yeah.
And that's considering sigma's fixed. Right. The n changes. We make n bigger. It makes sigma squared over n smaller. So making the variance smaller will tighten the distribution. This will mean less overlap. That's our thing we want to do. That's the way we're going to increase power. Sigma squared sub x bar, that's just the variance of the sampling distribution of the mean, is a function of n. So just increase n. Now again, think about this. If that's not quite clear to you, remember, central limit theorem tells us that the variance of the sampling distribution of the mean equals sigma squared over n, right? And remember, we're dealing with sampling distributions, not population distributions. Okay, now let's look at this. Sigma squared can't change. It's a parameter. Parameters don't move. Statistics move. So if that thing, sigma squared sub n, that's actually our variance of our sampling distribution, if we can change that, no, we can't, but we can change the n. So we can't change sigma squared, we can change n. As n gets bigger, if this thing's the same, if sigma squared is the same, n gets bigger, this quantity itself is going to go down. So when that quantity goes down, that means the distributions are getting tightened up. That's why increasing n gives you more power, is because you get less overlap. You get less variance. Your estimates become more accurate. Okay? Does that make sense? You okay with that? All right. Now, we have to somehow measure the size of a potential effect we get. While it is true increasing n is the way to do that, is the way to increase power, how do we know how big our effect is? Well, let's just think about this. The size of our effect is mu1 minus mu0. It's how different the alternative is from the null. Right? That's the effect. The thing is, that's going to depend on variance. So let's standardize it. If it depends on something, we're going to divide by it. So we're going to, our difference, that's d for difference, is going to equal mu1 minus mu0 over sigma. What that says is that, let's say we have, and I'm going to try to draw one of these pictures, and you'll see why you're very, very happy that I got it on a slide. Okay. Okay, so there's mu1, there's mu0. Quite a bit of overlap. Now, if the difference... Okay. And right there. Hardly any difference there. Like, hardly any overlap there. But the difference, the size is the same. But that's because the variances are smaller here than they are here. You see the point I'm making? So what we want to be able to do is say that's actually a bigger effect than this. Because it is, right? There's no overlap here. There's a lot of overlap here. That's what this D quantity is doing. Mu1 minus mu0 over sigma, that's what it's doing.
Can we calculate that?
No. Because you can't, because you don't know mu. Yeah, or sigma. This is all theoretical for right now. How do you get that? I mean, you could try, Danielle. Prior research can help you here. So one of the ways you can do this is you can say, how big an effect am I looking for? Well, let's look at all the previous data. And in fact, you do this when meta-analyses kind of do this kind of thing. But if you look at the differences between groups over a couple of hundred studies and you see the size of an effect, that'll give you an idea of how big the overlap is and how big the difference is. That can do that. I've played with effect size before. You can do it. But you're making a lot of assumptions there. You're making a lot of guesses. How big an effect is big enough? That's the question you want to ask. Right? Like, look, I can tell you right now that you take almost any variable and you get a correlation between it and some other variable. Right? Very few things have exactly zero. I bet the size of your big toe correlates with how, as an adult, how quickly you can, how well you can run the 400 meters. I bet it does. I picked something. Do you think it matters? If you tested 10,000 people and looked up the significance, you'd probably find it's a significant effect, and it's probably a correlation of 0.0003 or something. Who cares? Is it big enough to be interesting? The answer there is probably no. Let's say we're talking about something like a drug, and we want to say it's a new drug, and we want to see if it's going to be more effective. Like, is a better drug for, like, a pain drug, let's say, or something like that, or an AIDS drug, something like it's, you know, important. But the side effects might be kind of nasty. Well, if the side effects are nasty and we already have drugs that kind of work for some of these things, it better really work well. There better be hardly any overlap. It better be like, I know this, it's a huge difference. Because if it's a huge difference, you say, look, this is really unpleasant, but you're going to live? Well, that's not bad. So it's that kind of thing. You're asking yourself, how big an effect am I looking for? What you're saying is, how big should D be? Now, a guy named Cohen came up with an idea here, so now we don't have to actually do any calculating. What we do with Cohen's method is he talked about small, medium, and large effects. And he said, how much overlap is there? A small effect, so an effect size of 0.2 gives you 85% overlap. That's probably like 85%. That's even more than this. Yeah. Because that's a large effect, actually. Probably. Medium effect, 0.5, is 67% overlap. In other words, two-thirds of the distributions overlap with each other. Like two-thirds of one is the other one. And finally, a large effect, 0.8, is 53%. Okay? Go ahead.
If you have more overlapping, wouldn't that make it...
Yeah.
Show that it's not.
Power. Yeah. That's right.
Because would you be increasing beta with more overlap?
Yes. Okay. Exactly. Thinking back to the original picture there, exactly that's what it does. So small, medium, large. Typically, what do people do? People go, I like medium, it's in the middle. If an effect, look, if there's at least 67% overlap or less, I'm interested. 85% is like, boy, this better be a really important discovery because there's hardly, they're almost the same distribution. Right? This is just a rule of thumb. It's not like it's anything magic or it's anything that, but it's become accepted as something that's pretty useful. Okay, so we've got an idea of how big our effect size should be. Even though we don't know what mu is, mu 1, mu 0, or sigma. But we've got an idea of what mu 1 minus mu 0 over sigma is, and we want it to be about 0.5. So what do you want to do with that? We combine that information, the effect size, with the effect of sample size. See, what we're going to try to do here, we're going to try to guess how many subjects we need to find a big-sized effect, a medium-sized effect, or a small-sized effect. If we can do that, then we don't waste time. Honors thesis students are notorious this way. They come in and they say, I want to get 120 subjects. And I look at them and I say, why?
So are we just using like Tolman's method to determine what effect size we want? Like what?
You look at that and typically you go 0.5 is what you really is. Sort of, yeah. Pretty much. But I often have these thesis students come to me at the beginning of the year and I say, how many people do you want to test? And they say, 120. And I say, well, why? Is it so hard to find that you need 120 people to find it? If you can't find this with 20 subjects per group, you probably should quit. That's what I usually tell people. It's like, it's not interesting, right? Unless it's some huge earth-shattering thing. So we're going to combine this information about D with the effect of sample size. We're going to use something called the delta statistic. That's a small Greek letter, delta. Okay, I don't know, that looks funny. Delta equals D, that's your effect size, times the effect of N, the function of N, how N affects the statistic. So this is very generally used because we can use this then for analysis variance. We could use it with t-test, which is how the example we'll use today because it's probably the easiest one to understand. So we got D and we got the function of N, like how N affects the statistic we're going to use. In this case, it'll be a T. So for T, F at N then equals the square root of N because that's how it affects it. Right, because think about a t-test. On the bottom, there's s over square root of n.
Will we ever be using indifferent function then?
Sure. If you're using analysis of variance, you'd use n.
Just
n. Yeah, it wouldn't be square root of n. I just bit my tongue. Ow. Hurts. key. I once sliced my lip open teaching with an overhead.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, like a paper cut, except it was an overhead cut. I was looking very closely because I can't see very well, and I was taking off the paper, and it went... And then blood was dripping on the overhead thing, and the whole class, back in Newfoundland, the whole class is seeing drips of blood go on the screen. Bloop, bloop. It was like they'd just been hit and caught in modern warfare or something. Bloop. And I turned around, and I swore like crazy because it hurt like hell, and I was bleeding everywhere. And then I took a cup of coffee and dipped my lip in it to try to cauterize the wound. It was good times. So just biting my tongue is no big deal. So yeah, we would, if we're using an Alice variance, we'd use N, not square root of N, because we use variance there, not standard deviation. Okay. It's actually not that bad. It's the thinking backwards that's weird and saying, oh, 0.5 is good. So you got to remember, first of all, you're setting that. You're saying 0.5. If you know D, and I got no in quotes, because you don't really know it, but you're saying, what would I be interested in? You can now find out the given a sample size needed for a given power. So now what this does, let's say we know D is 0.5, because that's what we almost always use. It's in the middle. It's medium. 67% overlap. Okay. I can taste blood in my mouth from biting my tongue. It's so unpleasant. Like I said, by the way, you usually would pick 0.5. It's kind of fun to pick 0.8 and see how many extra subjects you'd have, you know, how many subjects you'd need, or 0.2, you might need a lot of subjects. If you say 0.8, though, you're banking on saying it's a big effect. 0.5 is just safe. Let's say we want a power of 0.8. See, again, I just picked the power. Right? So I want a power of 0.8. In other words, I want an 80% chance if there's something there, I'm going to find it. There's a 20% chance then, by the way, that if there's something there, I'm going to miss it. Right? But let's say we want an 80% chance. And that's not an uncommon number to pick. It's not an uncommon number to pick. Because false negatives aren't nearly as scary as false positives.
The power force one delta?
Pardon me?
In the equation, the power force one is delta?
No.
No?
No, it's the non-centrality parameter of the T distribution. It's a thing. Don't worry about it. Yeah. No, well, you'll see in a second. It's actually not that bad. It involves plugging a bunch of numbers in and looking something up in a table. It's that simple. There's an appendix in your book called Power. It's the Power appendix. So really, this is just using another table. So D equals 0.5, 1 minus beta is going to be 0.8, and alpha is going to be 0.05. And there's the, oh, it's very not a very good scan, though, is it? It's hard to see. Darn. What if I could see that with the lights way down? No, that makes it worse somehow. It's magical. You can read on my screen here. That's funny, I can read on my screen halfway decently. So you see alpha is 0.05. Do you see that? Did anybody have the table out? Because then you can, it's hard to, I would show you on here, but it's just a.
I have a book.
Yeah, look up the power appendix. This is going to tell us what delta is going to equal. There it is. Okay, let's take a look. Look for D equals 0.5.
Okay, is that like the delta?
No, the D equals 0.5. Yeah. Let's see. All right. All right. So, yeah, 0.05. And Power of 0.8. Let's go down to there. Yeah, that's right. Our delta is going to equal 2.8. Okay, do you see that? Look, you look in the appendix. 0.05, power of 0.8. So you read the entry until you get the 0.80, right there. Our delta is going to come out, that's right, to 2.8. So that's going to, now you're going to get delta. You've got D. That the table gives you delta. You've got D. The only thing we have to get now is N. So is this all this fancy stuff? Yeah, great. So it zooms in and I can't see it. All right. How did I get that? I rearranged the formula. I cross-multiplied. So what I end up saying is that N equals delta over D squared. It equals 2.8 over 0.5 because we set D. We set D. Delta we had to look up because we get the power and we get the alpha. We square it and we get 31.36. We need 31.36 people. If we have a medium effect size, we have a regular old t-test, we're going to need 32 people if we want a 0.8 power. Do you want me to show you how I did that? Because, I mean, is that confusing somehow, or... Are you okay?
I'm not even turning the table because I see where you got the 0.05, but I don't know where you lodged it up.
0.05, look for the entry for 0.8. Keep going down, you get to 0.8, and then it'll give you a delta.
Oh, okay.
Can we go back?
And then it's 2.80 for delta.
See what it says here? Delta equals D times... So delta, which is a funny thing to draw, equals D times the square root of N. What I want to do is I want to isolate N. Right? I'm solving for an unknown. I'm going to know delta in D. I already told you what D is. I'm going to pull delta out of a table. So let's go square root of N equals delta over D. Which means there. Yeah. I'm just solving for an unknown. So that's how I got N equals delta over D squared.
Does this work if you're comparing two groups?
Yes.
How would you do that?
It would actually end up working the same way, except now you're going to need... Sixteen. 32 people.
Who just divided?
Yeah. Yeah, because the degrees of freedom come out the same, eh? Yes, Steph?
What is the definition of delta?
Delta is the non-centrality parameter of the... T distribution given HA is true. I can tell you what it is. I can tell you what delta is. This actually may help you a little bit. T, right, when we do T, it equals this. Doesn't it? Right? That assumes the null hypothesis, doesn't it? It always does. And then we find out how likely it is and we reject it. Delta is this. Except it assumes the alternative hypothesis with a given sample, with the alternative hypothesis with a given effect size. Yeah. So it's a non-central T rather than a central T assumes the null. A non-central T assumes the alternative.
So it assumes HA is true.
Yeah.
Rather than
HA. And it's a parameter that if you were to calculate a T, like what the distribution itself should actually look like. There's a parameter in there called the non-centrality parameter, and then which would normally be zero, because we assume the null hypothesis is true. So if you're actually calculating it, which nobody does, but if you're actually calculating a whole t-distribution, part of it is, that's one of the, just like you know with the z, there's a whole long formula for how you actually do the function. There's one for t, too. It's got delta in it. Yep. So, like I said, it's not that bad. You see all we end up doing is we do delta over d squared. I think it's a shame that my cool zooming in effect here in Keynote didn't work. All that goes away. Look at that. Isn't that nice? But I can't. Because the projector sucks. Because it worked in a different room. So, delta over d squared, 2.8 over 0.5, 31.36. Let's increase the power. Let's go nuts. Let's say, I want all kinds of power. I got to find an effect. Let's make it 0.99 instead of 0.8, because I think that's the last entry in the table, isn't it? The delta value now from the table, I think, is 4.2. 420. I love people on Xbox Live who have their name in 420. Like, that's so clever. Way to go. And they're mostly like 14-year-old kids that, you know, maybe their parents have smoked weed. But anyway, just thought I'd throw that out there. Is it 4.2? Did I read that properly? Because it's for 0.05. Oh, because it gets to the point where it's 0.99, 0.9999, 0.99000. Yeah. So it's 4.2. Now we need 71 people. We've gone up by, 20%, right? From 80 to almost 100. So we'll call it 20, that's 25%, isn't it? We've gone up a 25% jump in power. And we've had to double our subjects. Oh. Well, that's no good. That's no good. So what the hell is delta? It's the non-centrality parameter. So we assume HO, but under HO, the expected value of T is zero. And why is that? Look at this. This should equal this. They come from the same distribution, right? X bar should equal mu. So under HO, the expected value of T is zero. And we assume HO when we do the statistics. In other words, how likely is it that we will find a value of delta that is greater than the critical value of T of 0.05? That's what delta is doing. So delta equals x bar minus b over s divided by square root of n, and it's not equal to zero. Because if it's equal to zero, HA is not true. Right? HO is true. So for those of you that really, really want to know what it is, it's that. It's basically a T formula but assuming HA is true. Which is exactly what we've been doing today. We're assuming HA is true. Now, here's how much overlap do we have?
If you assume HO is true, they basically just take the mesh right, sit on each other.
Well, that's right. And then if HO is true, though, that non-centrality parameter in the T function is zero.
You just sit on each other.
Yes, that's right. And we always assume that. We always assume the null hypothesis. We always do. And then what we're trying to do it always with statistics. We say, we have one assumption we want to violate, and that's that the null hypothesis is true. Because if every other assumption hasn't been violated, and it's exceedingly unlikely that this number would come out, we must have violated an assumption. Oh, I bet it's that one, because it's the only one we haven't violated. Yep. Now, the thing is, I'll tell you something. What I usually ask students when they come and they ask me these questions about power, when they're going to do their honors thesis, and I say, how big an effect are you looking for? And I say, how much overlap do you think there is? We'd look at a couple of papers, and you find out, like, is it 0.00005 always come in? I say, yeah, fine. Let's make D1 if we're going to calculate this. Because there's, hardly any overlap. If that's the case, so many times I tell people, if, I don't know, 10 subjects per group should find it. If it's a nice big effect, huge. that's bigger than Cohen. That's like one. Yeah. That. Yeah. It's in the T. There's a function for T. It's a distribution. Just like, remember that crazy function for Z? Right? With like 1 over 2 pi times to the sigma, all kinds of crap like that. Well, there's something like that for T, too. It's just... T equals zero, you assume that because if the null hypothesis is true, then x bar equals mu. Right? So you think that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Well, then if the null hypothesis is true, T equals zero, theoretically. Okay. We want that not to happen. We're not trying to prove the null hypothesis. We'd be wasting our time.
So if it doesn't equal zero, then the null hypothesis is not true?
It's not that if it doesn't equal zero, if it's different enough from zero. No, it's not proving it. It's trying to reject the null. We always assume the null. Every statistical test starts out with a bunch of assumptions, and then there's always one assumption there for every test, and that's that the null hypothesis is true. That's why, remember I said one of the assumptions of T? That all the variances are equal. If I assume the variances are equal, and HO says the means are equal, that means the null hypothesis is true. Let's try to reject that. So we don't violate any other assumptions. The thing comes up, the T comes up, and it says, boy, that's really unlikely. Why would it be unlikely? Because we violated an assumption. What assumption? Well, we didn't violate anything else. Must be the null hypothesis. Therefore, it's not true. That's the whole logic of using these mathematical procedures to make these kind of decisions. So if you really want to know, it's this non-centrality parameter. This is something that's really important to you. It's the kind of question I would ask, I know that. Because I was like, but why? I was always like that. The thing I'm going to tell you to take away from this is you can always look this up. This isn't something I know how to do off the top of my head. But I know that I have tables. I know I have, there's a way to calculate these things. And when I do stuff, I try to do power calculations if I can. For analysis of variance, it's a little bit more complicated, but I have a book. A really good book called Experimental Design. It's not a good, it's a great statistics book. It's not like a page turner, but it's a great statistics book. And in the back, there are these power functions, these crazy looking tables with exponential functions going everywhere. But you can look and I can say, okay, how big the effect is, how many subjects, how many groups, is it, what kind of design is it? You need 9 people per group. Right? And doing it for a t-test, you can see there, it was actually not that hard a thing to do. So if you can, either do them or talk to somebody about it. Okay? When you go to do your thesis. Thanks, guys.
I don't care anymore what you say about me. I don't hear you at all. I'm not feeling a thing. It's not real if all my memories erase. I don't think about us as for my mental state. It's just an ordinary day.
podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.